The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Students of the Game. My name is Alex Malman, and today I'm joined by just Nathan Glyball, Gray Oldenburg, and prior Ravens he had to attend to. All right, we got Triple A today. The first story we have is the Milwaukee Bucks fired head coach Mike Budenholzer after losing to the 8-seed Miami Heat in the first round of the NBA playoffs. Nathan, do you think this was the right decision for the Bucks to go ahead and fire Budenholzer after he got them the championship a couple years ago?
I think it's absolutely stupid that a championship head coach is fired just 2 seasons after winning the championship. Obviously, it is a disappointing first-round exit when you lose to an 8-seed as a 1-seed, but you got to understand that this Miami Heat team was not really 8-seed caliber. I mean, they have a pretty stacked roster, and honestly, if they played better during the regular season, I think they would have been top 5 seed in the East. But you know, that's just how the cards played out, and they were the 8-seed. And it just didn't work out for the Milwaukee Bucks. But you know, Mike Budenholzer as a head coach, he has done a terrific job. I know there's been times and games where people have questioned his decision making, but overall, he led you to the championship, and you can't really just throw him away like that.
Yeah, I look at this, and I'm just wondering who the Bucks think they're going to hire to replace him that's going to do a better job. I mean, Ime Udoka just got hired by the Rockets, and then you have Nick Nurse on the market as well. But I'm not sure if he's going to be able to or going to want to get back into coaching this soon, especially for the Bucks. How much pressure is going to be on him to win games? And I mean, you saw it now. If you don't get past the first round, you're gone. Even if you had the best record in the league, I look at Mike Budenholzer. I thought he did a great job for the Bucks, like you said, Nathan, winning that championship a couple years ago. But just his inability to like coach end of games. I mean, you saw in the Heat series, there was a couple games where it was at the end, and he just didn't know how to manage the game. And in Game 5, they had opportunities to win it in the final possession, and he didn't call a timeout. Instead, he let it run out, and they didn't get a shot off, I don't believe. Or they may have, or that may have been like a half-court shot, something terrible. I think Mike Budenholzer is a great coach. He just got dealt a bad hand. I mean, the Heat, like you mentioned, just mentioned, Nathan, we're not an 18 caliber team. They're definitely a top 5 seed. They just didn't have a great regular season. Jimmy Butler was definitely him in the playoffs. We saw it game in and game out, still doing it. I think this was a stupid decision by the Bucks, especially how much Giannis loved Mike Budenholzer. I don't think this is going to work out well.
It's definitely not. You think about – it's not just on Mike Budenholzer. Obviously, he's a head coach, but they're honestly using him as a scapegoat. Some of your star players don't have the same production that they had in the regular season, and that's what it comes down to. They didn't convert in the playoffs, and they didn't win games that they needed to, and it all falls back on Mike Budenholzer, and he gets the axe for it.
I mean, in the last game, I think Giannis missed like half his free throws or something like that. And he had like 20 plus free throws. So, I mean, if he makes those free throws, they win that game. It's not on Mike Budenholzer. I know we had the botched call at the end, but I mean, you had ample opportunities to win that beforehand.
Yep.
All right. Second story we have today is the University of Alabama has fired head baseball coach Brad Bohannon after his link to suspicious bets on the LSU versus Alabama game on April 28th. Sources familiar with the investigation reported that the person who placed the bets was caught on video communicating with Bohannon while he was at the sports book, while he was doing so. Do you think Alabama made the right decision here firing Bohannon? And what are your thoughts on him doing this?
Yes, absolutely. He needed to be gone. This guy's an idiot. I mean, you gotta believe. You think about the number of people who actually bet on college baseball, and you know, prior to this game, there were no bets on it. And then you have your guy not only go and place one bet, you have the guy place 2 bets of large caliber, you know, money values on this game. So obviously it's going to be flat as suspicious. You talk about how Alabama's starting pitcher was pulled from the lineup just hours before the game on Friday. And you know, Brad Bohannon then plugs in a pitcher who hasn't pitched since March. So obviously it looks like the game is rigged. And you know, they checked his phone records and obviously he had been communicating with the guy in Cincinnati. So, I mean, he got caught. I don't understand how stupid you could possibly be to bet on a game like this. It just shows that he has no character. I mean, you're just selling your team out. I mean, it's just sad.
Yeah, this is definitely idiotic. I mean, like you just mentioned, Nathan, the fact that nobody really bets on college baseball and you go place 2 large bets on an Alabama versus LSU game, there's going to be some suspicion there, some investigation done. And just the fact that he decided that was a good idea, I don't know what he's thinking. He was a good coach for Alabama. I mean, he didn't light the world on fire, but Alabama baseball really isn't the number one sport. But he did have he was over 500 in his coaching there. He made an NCAA tournament appearance, and he had 20 players drafted in the MLB drafts. I mean, that's very successful there. Alabama was 30-15 this season. So, I mean, he's done great things there, and this is going to be really bad. It's going to tarnish his legacy. I doubt he gets another job in college baseball or college in general. Might not even get an MLB job the way this is looking. It's just a stupid decision he made that's going to cost him his career probably.
Yep. His career is over. I mean, once you do something like this, there's not coming back.
All right, the third story we have today is former Alabama and Las Vegas wide receiver Henry Ruggs III pled guilty to one count of DUI resulting in death and one count of misdemeanor vehicular manslaughter stemming from the fatal crash in Las Vegas he was involved in back in November 2021. With that, he will serve between 3 and 10 years in a Nevada state prison. Nathan, what are your thoughts on the Henry Ruggs situation and him pleading guilty?
Obviously, what he did was awful. You know, young people make stupid decisions. We're right there with him with stupid decision making, but this is something that is irrefutable. Just taking lives of innocent people. I know that Henry Ruggs regrets his decision, but he needs to serve time for what he did and get past what he did. And obviously the guilty plea, I mean, that's the right thing to do. You know you're in the wrong, and you're going to take responsibility for your actions. So Henry Ruggs, I think he'll spend some good time in prison, and he'll learn from what he did, and he'll come back a better person because of it.
Yeah, thoughts go out to the person that lost their lives in that crash. I mean, that was just a really stupid decision by Ruggs to do that. He was driving with a blood alcohol level of twice the legal limit in Nevada. I mean, that's just stupidity there. He's paying the price for his decision, and I like you said, Nathan, it's good that he's taking responsibility for it by pleading guilty. But this should have never happened. I mean, he had a bright future ahead of him. He just made a stupid decision that's going to cost him dearly and cost a woman her life.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the final story we have today is Bronny James, son of LeBron James, the number 19 recruit in ESPN's rankings for the class of 2023, has committed to USC to play basketball. Nathan, what do you think on Bronny going to USC, which is very close to where LeBron plays for the Lakers?
Yeah, honestly, I thought that he was going to end up going to Ohio State. It was a kind of flip commitment thing. And obviously, throughout Bronny James's kind of recruitment, people have struggled to get in contact with him. There's a whole process to even just get in contact with LeBron to really just recruit Bronny James in general. So that kind of like push a lot of bigger colleges away. But obviously, it's kind of a location fit. I mean, USC is a big university. I mean, we'll definitely get a lot of recognition there. I don't think that Bronny is as good as people say he is. Obviously, his time in high school has been insane, and people are already expecting him to get drafted. But honestly, I feel like that just goes back to, you know, who his dad is and not what Bronny James actually brings to the table. Obviously, I think he's a good player. I think he'll be a very good player for USC. But as far as getting drafted, I don't know where I stand quite on that yet.
Yeah, I definitely expected him to go to USC with it being in close proximity to where LeBron plays for the Lakers. I like this decision. He's going to be pairing with the number one recruit in the class, Isaiah Collier. They got Boogie Ellis returning as well. I mean, USC is pretty stacked next season with all these guys coming in. Bronny's not going to be the go-to guy, I don't believe, with Boogie Ellis and Isaiah Collier being there. Like you mentioned, Nathan, I really don't think he is worthy of this 19 overall recruit, five-star caliber they're giving him. I believe he's probably a 3 to 4 star caliber player. I mean, he didn't really inspire me the way he played high school and, you know, in the AAU IBL circuit. I think he's, like you mentioned, Nathan, a little bit overrated just because his dad's name is LeBron James. I think if he was somebody else's son, like just a random person, probably wouldn't be this high of a recruit. But I mean, he is talented. You can't take that away from him. He's shown the ability to be good. I highly believe he's going to be drafted in the first round, regardless, probably lottery pick. But you look at this, when Bronny, if he leaves after one season at USC and goes to the NBA, his father will be 40 years old. And LeBron did say he wants to play with his son before he retires. So it'll be interesting to see who decides to try to gamble on Bronny James and hopefully gets LeBron in the process. that'll be cool to see. And then also the fact that his NIL evaluation is $5.9 million, which is $2.5 million larger than any other college athletes. Nathan, what do you think about that being his evaluation, even though he hasn't played anything college-wise?
It just goes back to who his dad is. That's how he gets all this attention. That's how he is a five-star recruit. And that's how he's already looking at getting drafted. I think that, you know, if my dad was LeBron James, I'd be over here making a bunch of money too. Obviously, it's going to be interesting to see where his career goes. But he definitely has a lot of help.
Yeah, I think he's got the help and the talent to be successful in the league. Just going to be interesting to see if he pans out well. All right, Nathan, week four of the USFL, what do you got for us?
Yeah, this week was probably back to normal, or as close back to normal from last week, where we had an insanely weird week where all of my picks were just completely wrong. As always, let's go ahead and start off with our players of the week. Starting on offense, Houston Gamblers running back Mark Thompson, who made his return last week. He ended up having 13 carries, 134 yards, and 3 touchdowns with the Gamblers' huge win. The defensive player of the week being New Orleans Breakers linebacker Vontae Diggs, who had 12 tackles, 2 tackles for losses, and half a sack. And the special teams player of the week being Birmingham Stallions kick return Deion Kane, who had a 91-yard kickoff return touchdown to seal that game versus the Maulers. Obviously, there was a lot happening this week, a lot of surprises. I think the biggest surprise we're about to jump into being the Houston Gamblers winning against the Philadelphia Stars 41-16. To start, Case Cookus has no help. We've said this for about 2 straight weeks now. The Stars have no running attack. Case Cookus was the leading rusher for the team with just 16 yards. But it's really a hats-off situation to the Gamblers. Kenji Bahar has continued to improve every single week since the season opened. He ended up having 15-21, 230 yards and 2 touches in the game. But really, it was Mark Thompson getting it done on the ground. A lot of credit to the Gamblers offensive line getting holes open for him. It's been insane, the downfall of the Stars since week one versus the Showboats. I really thought that they were one of the better teams in the league. But now, after back-to-back losses, you really question where they stand.
Yeah, you look at the Stars. I mean, Case Cook is, like you said, Nathan, has absolutely no help. I mean, it's all on his shoulders to win a game. He was tied for the leading rusher. He had 189 yards passing. I mean, that's not near enough. But when you're having to run for your life back there, having to do everything, you're going to be pretty tired throwing the football. And the running game is non-existent. Matt Colburn, 6 carries, 16 yards. Dexter Williams, 3 carries, 12 yards. I mean, that's pretty poor. I'm pretty sure I could go get more yards of that as running back. But it also comes on the fact that their offensive line couldn't block anybody. I'm pretty sure I could get through and blitz Case Cookus. It's atrocious. There is literally – he literally has no help outside of his receiving core. Outside of Devin Gray, nobody had over 4 receptions. I mean, Corey Coleman was held to 27 yards. Doran Sewell was held to 26. That offense is just awful. I'm very surprised because the amount of talent they have on that side of the football. Their defense doesn't provide any help either. Didn't force an interception. They did force a fumble, but they only got 1 sack, 3 TFLs. I mean, there's nobody on that defense that really stands out to you, that really worries you when you're preparing for a game. It's just the Stars are just underwhelming. But then on the flip side, the Gamblers, I'm very surprised how good they're playing. I mean, that game, the Stars, 463 yards to 199 yards. They dominated time of possession by almost 10 minutes. They had 7.5 yards per play, which is absolutely amazing. That's astounding. Kenji Bahar continues to amaze me every week. Week one, I was calling for his job. Now I think he's probably the second best quarterback in the league. So there's that. Mark Thompson is like Wes Hills 2.0. It'll be interesting to see if he can continue his dominance next week. Their receiving core is pretty good. I mean, even Justin Hall, their best receiver, didn't have that great of a game, and they still ended up winning. Their defense, once again, great. Shut down Case Cookus in that offense. They had 6 sacks, 5 TFLs. And then the defensive end, Reggie Walker, had 2 sacks himself. So, I mean, this Gamblers team continues to improve week in and week out. And I'm honestly surprised we're sitting here and they have a winning record.
Did you think the Gamblers were capable of beating the Stars this bad?
If you asked me before the season, looking at the schedule, I would have told you this game probably would have been the Stars beating the Gamblers 41-16. So I did not see this coming at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's just been insane how poorly the Stars have performed. It seems like they get worse every week. And I always expect them to, you know, have a redemption week, and they just don't. Jumping into the second game of the weekend, being the Memphis Shivers picking up their first win against the Michigan Panthers, winning 29-10. You know, every week prior to this, the Shivers just you had the first week against the Stars where you thought, hey, there's some problems with the team. Then they get beat down by the Stallions, and then they come up short in some close games, but they finally pick up a win here. The Panthers have been on the downfall. They do not have an answer to their quarterback problem. You know, they switch out between Carson Strong and Josh Love. Both end up being absolutely terrible, both throwing an interception. Reggie Corbin hasn't been the same since the game versus the Stars. And it's like the Panthers defense doesn't have an answer anymore. Breland Speaks has been nowhere to be found. And the Showboats really took advantage of it.
Yeah, look at the Showboats. I was very surprised for them to beat the Michigan Panthers here. But the difference for me was the Showboats were able to establish that running game. Last week we saw them have no running game whatsoever, which kind of was a downfall there. Cole Kelly really didn't pass the ball extremely well, but he did get two rushing touchdowns, and their running back, Kareth White, was able to get 54 yards on the ground. Their defense was able to force those two turnovers, which kind of were the difference in the game. And they were able to have a fumble recovery for a touchdown, where the defensive end, Jeff McCulloch, literally like snatched the ball out of the quarterback's hand and just strolled into the end zone. It was pretty comical to watch. But the MVP for the Showboats is really their kicker, Alex Kesman, who was 3-for-3 on field goals and had 250-plus yarders. That really was a big thing for the Showboats team, who continues to show the inability to finish drives game in and game out. I mean, look at the Panthers. Week one, I think we both agreed that they looked like the best team in the league, the way their defense played and the way their quarterback, Josh Love, was playing. And since then, it's like this team is on a whole 180, and they're back to what they were last season. Their quarterback situation is just as bad as it was last season. Josh Love has regressed immensely. I'm not sure where he's at, what he's been doing. He does nothing. Then you have Carson Strong. He doesn't do anything either. He provides nothing in the run game. His passing is just as bad. And their running backs were given a combined 26 carries and really weren't able to establish a running game with either of them. Both of them had over 50 yards, but none of them had over 100. So it's like this offense has like no weapons. Joe Walker had a great game. That was probably their shining star there. But outside of that, their offense has nothing. I'm very surprised how poor it is, considering how Josh Love played week one. I mean, looking at their defense, I mean, Mike Nolan, it's like he's back on the Cowboys now, the way he's coaching the defense. There's no production at all. And the week one, they had a great game. Breland Speaks looked like Defensive Player of the Year, and now it's gone. I don't know. This team looks like a new coach took over, and he doesn't know what he's doing.
You know, I think that there is truly a curse that you have, Alex, being that week two, you said Josh Love looked like an MVP candidate, and now he is just absolutely tarnished. And you look at, you know, how bad you said Kenji Bahar was, and now he's to a good point. Although you just said that he was the second best quarterback in the league, so I guess we'll probably start doing that as well, based on what you have been saying. Definitely a surprising result, but now there are no winless teams left. But there is an undefeated team left, jumping into the New Orleans Breakers versus New Jersey Generals. The Breakers, you know, kind of scooped by with a 20-17 win. And this game was really, you know, back and forth. It was really defensive oriented. It seemed like when this game first opened that West Hills was going to have the same dominant game that we've seen them have the last two games. But going into the second half, the New Jersey Generals really had an answer for them. But the one person that they didn't have an answer for being McLeod Bethel-Thompson, who went 26 of 37 and 279 yards. He really kept this Breakers team afloat when the Generals had an answer for West Hills. I really am impressed with what the Generals were able to do. I didn't think this game was going to be close going into it. But it really was a defensive battle. And if some plays go a different way, you could really talk about the Generals winning this game. I've been impressed with how the Breakers have been able to basically control time of possession. They definitely run way more plays than any other team. This game, they had 70 plays to the general 39. And that's just a recipe for success. West Hills, even with the kind of poor second half, he still had 26 carries at 88 yards and 2 touchdowns. Just absolutely crazy what he's been able to do for this team. And honestly, at this point, I don't see the Breakers losing at all.
Yeah, I think if you look at this game, I'm very surprised this wasn't a blowout like the Gamblers Stars game. The Breakers had the ball 38 minutes compared to the Generals 21 minutes, and they ran 70 plays to the Generals 39. So just looking at that, you would expect the game to be a pretty big blowout. But the Generals were able to keep them at bay. Their defense did a great job doing so. The Generals defense had 4 sacks, 3 TFLs, forced a turnover. But you look at the Breakers offense, West Hills was held under 100 yards for the first time this season. He did have 2 rushing touchdowns, but the one thing that made the difference for him this week was the fact he's able to get going in the receiving game. He had 7 receptions for 71 yards. Thought that was interesting to see how much they were able to get him in the passing game and how open he was every play, it looked like. But then outside of West Hills, I mean, this Breakers offense has so many weapons in the receiving game. I mean, you got Sage Surratt, their tight end, Dee Anderson, Jonathan Adams, Lee Morris. I mean, everybody on that team had over 4 receptions over 30 yards apiece. So it's just like week in and week out, you don't know who's going to have this dominant game, whether it be West Hills or somebody in the receiving game. I mean, or Bethel Thompson. I mean, this team is so versatile. It's crazy to me. But the Generals offense, I mean, it really does rely on these big chunk plays. We saw it last week was really the difference maker in them able to win that game. They did have a few chunk plays here and there. They averaged 7.1 yards per play, but they really weren't able to get in the red zone. Their offense was pretty poor. Dunter Johnson only had 113 yards passing. Their leading receiver had 2 receptions for 71 yards and a touchdown. And then their second one was one reception for 26 yards. So the Generals really lost this game on the fact they weren't able to convert on the offensive side of the football. If they can get that under control, this team is really poised to do good things, especially in this weak North Conference they're in. But that defense, it looks really, really elite.
Yeah, I think that the biggest turning point in this game was definitely when Darius Victor had that fumble. It seemed like the Generals were driving. They were going to match the Breakers touchdown, and Darius Victor kind of just fumbled the handoff. I thought that was huge. But, speaking on this Generals defense, being able to hold the Breakers 2 out of 5 red zone touchdowns, I think that they've been the only team to do that thus far. The Breakers have had great success in the red zone, always converting, really. But, it shows that the Breakers do have some weak spots. And if your team can hold them in the red zone, then maybe you have a chance to win a game versus the Breakers. Jumping into the last game of the weekend, he had the Birmingham Stallions taking on the Pittsburgh Maulers. Birmingham ended up getting the win 24-20 in what was a real back and forth game and came down to the last minute. The most surprising thing, the Maulers outgained the Stallions 311 yards to 281 yards. Talk about where the Maulers offense was these past few weeks to the Maulers offense this weekend was just insane to see. I definitely think that this game was so close because Alex McGee had 2 interceptions. You talk about the turnovers there. But ultimately he didn't get discouraged throughout the game. He did end up having a rushing touchdown and being the team's leading rusher, 10 carries for 48 yards. And of course that touchdown on the ground. And he did some fantastic things through the air too, being 17, 29, 157 yards and a touchdown. I was so surprised to see this game be so close. Not only that, but just the amount of success the Maulers had against the Stallions defense. It seemed like the Stallions defense didn't get off the bus for the second straight week. It was weird to see, but it really came down to the Maulers offense not being able to convert in the red zone, going 0-3 for red zone touchdowns. Kicking field goals it is not always a solution to win games, and that was a perfect example right here. But besides that, Troy Williams had a great game. He was the team's leading rusher as well, with 7 carries, 63 yards and a touchdown on the ground. And he really didn't make any mistakes. This was a game where it was perfect for the Maulers to win. But the biggest play, of course, being the game-sealing touchdown from Kickoff returner Deion Kane, he took it 91 yards to the house right after the Maulers scored. It kind of took all the air out of the stadium and kind of deflated the Maulers offense. It was really insane to see how fast Deion Kane was on that run. Alex, do you think he was I don't know. What would you say he was running there?
He looks like Tyreek Hill running down the field, so he's going pretty fast. Yeah, so you just look at the Maulers. I'm utterly surprised they even scored 20 points this week, considering they're going against the Stallions. Like you mentioned, Nathan Troy Williams had an amazing week. But really, outside of that, for the Maulers, I mean, their offense was pretty poor. I mean, their running back had 19 yards on the ground. They couldn't finish drives, like you mentioned, Nathan. That was a big Achilles heel for them, really lost them the game. But then flipping over to the Stallions, Alex Magoo, the way he was playing the first half, this is like last season, I think it would have been the time where you'd have seen Jamar Smith come in to replace him. But obviously, Jamar Smith can't do that now because he's out for the season. So they had to really continue with Alex Magoo. They were able to sneak out with a win. But Magoo really has to get this under control. These past 2 weeks have not looked great. The offense has looked pretty poor. It really comes down to the fact their offensive line can't block just like the Stars' offensive line. I mean, their running game can't really get going. I mean, you had Zaquandre Wright with 41 yards on 10 carries. But we saw last year how effective somebody like Bo Scarborough was on the ground. And we just don't have that this year. They have to get something in the running game going where Alex Magoo doesn't have to do everything on this offensive side of the football and have everything on his shoulders just like Case Cookus does. But the offense, the longest play is 15 yards. That's not how you win a football game. You got to get some big plays, take the top off a defense, something. We saw week one where the first play was like a 50-plus yard touchdown. So Skip Holtz has to call these plays, and we got to be able to find success where we get these big chunk plays and force this defense to keep them on their toes to where they're not stacking the line of scrimmage or playing these really close zones and stuff like that. The Stallions offense looks completely opposite what we saw last year. They really got to get this under control if they're going to do anything like they did with the championship.
I think that the biggest thing has been that tight end Jace Sternberger hasn't been as much of in the offense the last two games. You think about what he did in the first 2 weeks, and now in this game he only had one reception for 5 yards, and that was in the final 2 minutes of the game. I really think that Alex Magoo needs to get him more involved in the offense if they want to have success. But ultimately, it does come down to the offensive line. If you cannot run the ball effectively, like we've seen throughout this whole league, especially last week, you're not going to win football games. And that's been true for every single team who has struggled to run the ball. If the Stallions do not get it under control, then they're going to have some serious problems on their hands, not only on the offensive end, but on the defensive end too, because they will get tired from having to play the whole game. So, Alex, you know, we have a lot of things going on in the NFL. Obviously, some regular season changes coming up. What do you have for us?
Yeah, so the 2023 NFL regular season schedule will be released this Thursday, May 11th. And there are some changes coming to it. NFL will have a Black Friday game for the first time ever. Games won't necessarily belong to networks anymore. All games are now free agents. So that means they're not stuck to playing on Fox or CBS, stuff like that. And then teams can be on Thursday Night Football twice. And then not all teams are guaranteed to have a primetime spot. There's the four big changes that are coming with this season. Do you like any of those, Nathan?
Yeah, I think that it's really, it looks a lot more like the NBA now. You think about, you know, all these kind of lower teams that lose a lot, do not get any primetime games. I think there's been a lot of complaints in the past, speaking that some of the, you know, worser teams in the NFL have gotten primetime games just because that was what the NFL did. But now you can have multiple teams playing, you know, primetime games over and over and over again. I think it's going to bring a lot more viewers to the networks. I think that's been the big thing for the NFL. They want more viewers. And obviously, I think I really like the Black Friday game. That's going to be really interesting. You always have the Thanksgiving games, but it's kind of like deflated when you don't have anything on that Friday and you have to wait until the weekend again. So I really like that change.
Yeah, like you saw last year with Thursday Night Football on Amazon Prime, there was like a stretch of like 3 or 4 weeks where every game was poor. I think like I don't think any team scored like over 15 points or something like that or didn't score a touchdown. I mean, it was hard to watch. So I like the idea of not guaranteeing all these teams, these Thursday Night Football slots, primetime slots. because there's some teams that definitely do not deserve it when you get to the midpoint of that season and they're like 1-7 or something like that. So I really do like those changes. I think you're going to be good for the league for the season.
Do you have any teams in particular you don't want to watch in that season?
Just off the top of my head, I really you can't give me a second here. There's definitely trying to cycle through the teams in my head. Probably the Raiders. I prefer not to watch them. Josh McDaniels is not a head coach in this league. They have Jimmy Garoppolo at quarterback. It's hard to watch them play. Probably the Arizona Cardinals because Kyler Murray is out for the season, or at least for the first part of it. So there's that. And Nathan, I think you'll probably go with some different teams there.
Yeah, I definitely don't want to watch the Seahawks play. They kind of have this methodic pace of play that I just hate watching, especially on a Thursday night. And I definitely don't want to watch the Broncos play. I'm just tired of watching Russell Wilson make some stupid decisions. I'm tired of watching that poor offensive line just staying there. Those are probably the two teams. I'm sure there's going to be more as the season starts off.
Yeah, probably. All right, moving on to some NBA news. We had all the award winners announced for the past season. The MVP was Joel Embiid. The Defensive Player of the Year was Jaren Jackson Jr. The Most Improved was Lauri Markkanen. The Rookie of the Year was Paolo Banchero. And the Sixth Man of the Year was Malcolm Brogdon. And then you had the Most Improved being Lauri Markkanen. Do you like those award winners, Nathan?
Yeah, I think it was everything we expected. I think the one that I'm most controversial about is the MVP. I've liked what Joel Embiid has been able to do throughout the regular season. Obviously, I know that the MVP has nothing to do with playoff success, but it really seems like people were tired of seeing Jokic as the MVP. He does insane things night in, night out. And that's without a lot of help on the offensive end. You think about, you know, who all Joel Embiid has to help, and James Harden comes to mind. He has Tyrese Maxey with him there. He has a lot of offensive help, but when it comes down to the Nuggets, Jokic is just kind of there by himself, and he has people like Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. just firing up stupid shots throughout every single game. And it seems like he's always bailing this Nuggets team out during the regular season. To be honest, I see why he didn't get his third straight MVP. But I think in a different year, he probably would have won it.
Yeah, I agree with all those awards winners besides the MVP. I definitely thought Jokic, like you mentioned, Nathan, deserved it over Embiid. I think it was just voter fatigue with the fact Jokic won the last two and the fact Embiid had a great season and they wanted somebody else to win this award. I even think Giannis had a good argument to win this award as well, with the Bucks being the best team in the league record-wise and him playing lights out. I mean, I don't know how you give Embiid the award over Jokic, but I'm not a voter, so they have the power to do that. Jokic played lights out. The other questionable one was the Most Improved, going to Lauri Markkanen over a guy like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. But you look at how big of a jump Lauri Markkanen had going from the Cavs, where he was just like a rotational guy, to the foundational star for a Jazz team that's rebuilding now, with Donovan Mitchell on the Cavs now with that trade and Rudy Gobert on the Timberwolves. So I think you look at each of those guys being future superstars in this league, but Lauri Markkanen had the bigger jump. I think Shai had a great argument, but it's just Lauri Markkanen. So
yeah, obviously, you know my bias towards Shai and the Thunder. Obviously, I thought that Shai did amazing things this season. I think that in any other year, that's his award to win. But just what Lauri Markkanen had been able to do for the Jazz, you talk about after you know, getting rid of Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert, you think that this team is down in the dumps. You think that this team is looking at trying to get the first overall pick. But then you have a guy in Lauri Markkanen who makes his first All-Star appearance. He just did unbelievable things for the Jazz this season. Personally, I didn't think he was capable of being that number one guy on the Jazz. From what I watched him when he was with the Chicago Bulls or when he was with the Cavs, he just didn't look like he was capable of doing all of that. But definitely a big surprise, and he is definitely very deserving of that Most Improved Award.
All right, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to Students of the Game.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.